just wait a few, maybe two, three more minutes. Je pense qu'on va commencer. Welcome, bienvenue. Merci Lisa de fermer la porte. Je pense qu'il y a plus de gens dans le corridor qu'il y en a dans la salle. Welcome to this workshop for reapplicants to the BCLLB program. My name is Ali Martin-Mayer and I'm the Assistant Dean in Charge of Admissions here at the faculty. I'll be speaking to you in both languages for most of this workshop. And we hope to, I just wanted to mention the word reapplicant. I don't know if it exists, but repostulant is not a word that exists in French. I made it up. It didn't exist. So I hope you'll forgive me this transgression of the use of language. Je voulais vous remercier d'être ici aujourd'hui. I think it's quite courageous for you to be here. Last year we had... maybe 15 attendees, and because we videotaped the session and will be webcast, I guess a lot of people think they don't need to come to get the information, but you will get your questions answered today, so thank you for being here. This session, we had the first iteration of this session last year, and the reason behind it was that through the years we've met with a lot of candidates who were refused and looking to reapply, and they had a lot of questions about what to do to improve and understanding the process, and so we were always kind of repeating the same information, so we decided to hold this information session so that you can, so that it can be shared more broadly, it's more transparent, and I think it's worked really well. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it. The way it will work, because the session is being webcast, I know we're not a big group, but we will still do, I will go through the main part of the presentation, and we will have a Q&A at the end that will be as long as needed, and we will work with the flashcards so that I can read the question out loud so that it can be taped and answered and so on and so forth, but it usually works really well, and we have time to go through all the questions that everyone has. So you just received, in terms of documents, just move on. Okay, so this is just, I'll introduce you to who is in the room with me today, but you received three documents. This is the new recruitment information leaflet. It's hot off the press. You're the first group to see it. And there is some interesting information in there, that some of which we will discuss at this session. Sinon, il y a un sondage de rétroaction, en fait, pour savoir comment vous avez entendu parler de la séance et qu'est-ce que vous en avez pensé. S'il manquait certains éléments, ça nous aide à améliorer la séance d'une fois à l'autre. Puis sinon, évidemment, ça, c'est pour les questions. Puis si vous en avez besoin de plus, on en a plus. Alors, aujourd'hui, on va être deux personnes à vous parler et à répondre à vos questions, mais nous sommes cinq pour l'instant dans la salle qui travaillons ici. Donc, il y a moi, ensuite, il y a Stacy qui est ici, qui est notre étudiante ambassadrice, qui va vous adresser la parole dans quelques minutes. Et sinon, il y a Josie, qui est au fond, et aussi Lisa et Kelly qui sont venues pour nous supporter. Alors, c'est l'événement que Josie a organisé. Et donc, c'est la personne qui répond à vos courriels et qui organise les séances d'information, tout ça. Donc, si vous êtes en correspondance avec nous pendant l'année, ça sera avec Josie. Ou sinon, si c'est pas elle, ça va être sans doute Lisa ou quelqu'un d'autre de notre bureau. Donc, on est ici pour répondre à vos questions aujourd'hui ou une autre fois si vous pensez à une question demain matin. Ça va nous faire plaisir. So, the agenda for today is the following. After these kind of housekeeping announcements, we will have the student ambassador testimonial. And then we will speak about a few points. I don't know how many of you have looked at the webcast of last year's session. I'm curious. None of you? Great. So it won't be too redundant. It looks a bit like last year's, so I'm glad to hear that. So then we will talk about the reality of admissions to the Faculty of Law, the statistics. Then we'll speak about... tried to pin down what your refusal letter was trying to tell you about your application. There's a lot in there to unpack, and I will put some context to that. Then we will, that's kind of the working part of the workshop, we will work through grasping your strengths and weaknesses in your past application. Then we will speak about the common pitfalls when reapplying, useful tips, and then the Q&A. And the way it works, in my mind anyway, so parts one and two is to provide context for you to understand the process and the refusal. Points three and four is really the part where you have to look back at your application, and we're going to give you information on how to draw some conclusion about your own past application. And then points five, six, and seven are really looking forward to your reapplication going forward. What do you want to know? So we will now move to the testimonial of Stacy, who's our student ambassador. We made a call to all of our student ambassadors saying we would ideally prefer to have someone who is a reapplicant come and speak at this workshop. We didn't have any takers this year. It's true, it's early on in the process. Maybe we don't have all of our ambassadors locked in yet, but we are lucky to have Stacy come and speak to you as a successful applicant and how it went well and what her own struggles were, even though the result was positive in the end. So, Stacy.
Bonjour, bonsoir, peut-être. Je m'appelle Stacy, je suis une étudiante en deuxième année ici à la faculté. As was said, I wasn't a reapplicant, but I hope that I can still provide some context to life at the faculty and any student life questions, characterize a little bit the successful applicants in my year and kind of share our collective experience here at the faculty. I came straight from my undergraduate degree at the University of Ottawa and was successful in my first application and came here immediately after. There was definitely a time when I thought I was going to be a reapplicant. I received a lot of rejection letters before I was accepted to McGill, and luckily McGill was my first choice, so I was very, very happy about that. So I know it can be a very tough process to get that pile of letters. And so I really congratulate all of you for being here, and this is a really wonderful event that's being offered, and I wish you all the best of luck in your reapplication. It really is a fantastic faculty to be a part of, so I will speak a little bit more about that. I guess the first thing I can do is characterize a little bit my colleagues and classmates here at the faculty. And something that I wasn't I thought was interesting was that in my year, the second year is currently, the average age of admission was actually 24, which I thought was a really interesting, revealing just statistic about my year. That means that there are a fair few students who are in their early 20s or younger if you're coming straight from Stasia, but that also means that there's half the class that is in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, and all of those people have so many different life experiences that they bring to the faculty. A lot of people, very few people really followed my path of going straight from high school or Stasia, possibly an undergrad, straight into law school. I'm definitely one of, definitely kind of the minority in my year. So a lot of people have worked, have traveled, have done more education, have master's degrees, PhDs, all kinds of different life experiences, and that's really reflected in just our interactions with each other, in our learning at the faculty. A lot of people have those really enriching life experiences that they bring to the faculty, and that's part of what makes it so rich. So I guess this is just to say that there's a lot of opportunities or different paths that people follow before they end up here at the faculty, and everyone has their own story. A lot of just everyone has their own route of getting here, and there can be a lot of opportunities before you end up here at the faculty. I'm not sure what the statistics were for this year. I listened to the presentation from last year last night, and they mentioned that 12% of my year were reapplicants, and I thought that was also really interesting. There's 20-something people in my year that were unsuccessful their first time and reapplied and came back, and they're amongst us and doing very, very well. And I think that's a really encouraging thing to hear about my colleagues, and really says a lot to their dedication to the faculty and that they were willing to give it a shot, do whatever it was in the meantime, and now they're here at the faculty, and that's fantastic. I guess just don't be concerned about taking time off to do something else, or that you're going to be older when you get to the faculty. Those are concerns that I'm sure everyone has. Everyone is slightly concerned about their specific trajectory in getting to the faculty, but here everything really is just a value added to the faculty. And it really does pay off in the faculty. I'll speak to just the general student experience. Just that my colleagues are all fantastic, fantastic people, and it's immediately obvious when you meet any one of them why everyone was selected. It's really just an amazing richness of the faculty. So life, I mean, it's fantastic. You're all applying to McGill. That's fantastic. I think it's a fabulous school. I'm super happy here. The professors are fantastic. The faculty is fantastic. There's so many just pluses to the program. The trans-systemic program is absolutely fantastic. And I'll stick around for questions afterwards also if anyone is interested in kind of the day-to-day life at the faculty. So like I said, I wasn't a reapplicant myself, but I did listen to the testimonial from the student from last year, and they were fortunate enough to have a reapplicant that was able to do this presentation. And in that, his story I think was really inspiring. It was he applied straight out of SAGEP and then decided that he was going to go and do more education, decided to do an undergraduate degree and use that experience, and said that it really benefited him when he reapplied a few years later, and talked a little bit about how it changed his application to have that experience in the middle, whether it's working or going to school, and that it really does change your approach to the faculty, and also just the content and depth, or just content in general, of your application. So there's, it's never too late to apply to the faculty. We always want to have all of the experiences, whatever your life experience has been, here with us. That's my informal spiel on the faculty. If anyone has any questions, I can take them, or we can have a chat after. for it.
Question that could be more useful for a student to answer.
I'll stick around after.
Okay.
But thank you all for coming. It's encouraging to see you all here. And yeah. Sure. So for the webcast audience, the question was, what was your undergraduate program before coming here? I did my undergrad in political science and history at the University of Ottawa, and then applied and came straight here afterwards. All right, I will stick around, and I hope to talk to some of you after.
Thank you, Stacey. That was very nice. I thought, you know what, I was sitting there, and I thought, we can have a former student ambassador testimonial. I was a reapplicant. I came to law school after undergrad, but I had applied after CJEP, and I had not been accepted. So here it is. If there had been a session like this, I would have gone. It would have been helpful. And I realize, you don't realize on the, well, I was too immature, I realize now, to realize that I was unready. And it really was probably the better, I know it was the best thing for me to have that occasion to really reflect on why I wanted to come. I think the first time around coming out of CJEP, it's a lot about, it's so competitive to get in that you just want to prove to yourself or whatever to the world that you can do it, but the motivation was not necessarily the right one. So I'm with you. From a personal point of view, I'm with you. So I just wanted to ask, when we'll move along, who here, I know we don't have that many, but is currently, you would put yourself as a CJEP applicant who has been refused and wants to reapply. So we have one, two, okay, who has, you know, been applied after university degree, and one, okay, maybe more, who had been on the wait list and then are reapplying. Not here, no. Okay, so because a reapplicant can mean a lot of things, and so it can mean someone like my case or others who apply 3 years later after CJEP. So it's still a reapplicant, but there's a lot of time and growth that goes between the two applications. And then there are other ones who are refused kind of directly after university and then reapply the next year. So there are those who came very close and now are trying their chance again. So the workshop will speak about these different possibilities as we go along. Bon. So we start now the first part, which is putting context to the refusal. These are pictures we found. They're not ours. They're not actual law students. We found them in the database. So that's how you might have felt, kind of puzzled. I thought I really put all of my energy in this. I thought I had a good application. Oh, I'm so disappointed. I'm sad about this. What will I do? So the whole gamut of feelings can come into play, and I think being aware of that is of the emotional reality of the refusal is important for you to bear in mind and for us to bear in mind. And in that doing so, we really appreciate your politeness in dealing with the admissions office if you contact us in the context of your refusal. Good. So more context. There are over 900 applications that are refused every year. The application to class size ratio is about 8-1. So the very, very vast majority of candidates are refused, unfortunately. And I was thinking in terms of an analogy, here we are, maybe, 12 or 8 in the room. This room on the first day of the school year is full. I think it does sit about the size of the entering class. If we were to fill it with a refused candidate, it would probably require five or six of these rooms to fit. So it's a lot of most, and because of space issues, we do end up refusing a lot of files that are good, very good, that have positive elements. They are from smart, hardworking students who have done everything well in their lives, and they put it together and they apply, and a lot of them will be refused. Alors voici des petites statistiques que moi je trouve très intéressantes. On a fait cet exercice-là l'année dernière, puis on l'a refait cette année. Les chiffres sont un petit peu différents, pas beaucoup. Donc, pour le cycle d'admission qui s'est soldé à la rentrée 2014, 10% des candidats étaient des repostulants. Et ça, ce sont des repostulants, même s'ils avaient fait une demande il y a 10 ans. Ce n'est pas juste dans un passé très récent. Donc, ça représente à peu près 10% de notre bassin, 14% de nos offres. Donc, je trouve ça très encourageant. Et ultimement, 13% de la classe. Alors, ce qu'on voit là, c'est qu'il y a des gens qui sont admis la deuxième fois, qui choisissent de ne pas venir. Bon. Voilà, ça c'est... quand même intéressant à savoir. Et l'année dernière, oui, c'était 12% de la classe, qui était la classe entrante, qui était des repostulants. Donc, cette année, ça a été pas une mauvaise année pour les repostulants. OK. Là, on va commencer la deuxième partie de l'atelier. Comprendre ce que votre lettre de refus vous disait. This is the part where we look and try to understand the past. So we're looking back at your past application together and understanding the why of the refusal and analyzing that refusal. This is the start of the part that's a little painful, that puts the work part into the workshop, because we will be going through it, and with your own profile in mind, you will be able to work through this with us. This workshop is meant to be helpful. We wouldn't be doing it for any other reason, but I will be providing you with factual information. It's transparent information. It may not always be fun to hear, but nonetheless, we will work through it together, and I know you'll be listening with a positive attitude. Obviously, you're here. So I will look forward to explaining a bit more. So a bit of information about how we make these decisions. So I'll go into that a little bit. First of all, I wanted to talk about the competitiveness of the process. So you've seen the numbers, and a lot of people ask us why they were refused. Because it's so competitive to be admitted, we have to really do a long, hard, comparative exercise, which may lead to refusing perfectly suitable candidates. And so we refuse many files with positive elements. Ultimately, the reason why you were refused is that there were more stronger files ahead of you than space allowed. So that's the reality. So we will work on giving you a lot more information, but ultimately when someone says, well, I can't believe I was refused, the reality is there were more files who were stronger for the space we had. So it really ends up being a comparative exercise. As you know, the faculty has a faculty-based, committee-based admissions process that is premised on a holistic approach to the evaluation of your file. So what that means is that every element of your application is taken into consideration, also to put context to your grades, and the purpose of a holistic evaluation is to possibly allow someone to be admissible when they otherwise would have been refused on one ground alone. So it's a way for the committee to give itself a little bit of a margin to go and admit these files that might be a bit lower on one side, but have all these other really interesting qualities, and on the balance, it makes it a competitive file. The holistic approach does not mean that we favor candidates with lower academic performance over those with stronger academic performance. That seems obvious, but sometimes when refused candidates really believe in the strength of the non-academic part of their file, and they think that because McGill has a holistic approach, they stand a higher chance of being admitted here than to another Quebec faculty, law faculty, that admits only on grades. It's still very competitive grade-wise. So the elements we look at. So this holistic notion is really nice. What does it mean in the day-to-day of the admissions committee? So there are five documents we look at. There are your academic records, so CGEP University Masters, and LSAT if it is there, the CV, the personal statement, and the reference letters, plus if there are some extenuating circumstances with our supporting documents. As well, there is the element of linguistic abilities, and I will talk about this. So we look at all of these elements together. We ensure first that we ensure the linguistic abilities are there first. Then we make sure there is potential for academic success. And then we assess the potential for contribution, which stem usually from all of the other factors. We don't have any weights or cutoffs that the academic record is worth 50% of your evaluation and everything else is, the CV is 10%. And we don't have any of that. But in the practice of it, and I've read thousands and thousands of files and read committee comments on all these files, the committee can accept one, maybe two weaker elements in these five that I listed, supporting documents, I would say. But if you have two or more that are weak or comparatively quite weak to the group, it's probably not going to work. So, and the purpose of this workshop is for you to find out what those were so that you can work to redress them. So, it's going to be the second cycle now that we really make the linguistic abilities a first triage. So, if a file has zero evidence of proficiency in French and English, well, to be honest, the issue is more French than English. So if we see zero French anywhere in the file, the CV, the transcripts, self-admittedly, the file will go no further. We will go through it with a fine comb and make sure we haven't missed anything. But I think in this group, it doesn't surprise anyone, but sometimes when I'm out of province recruiting, it blows them away that someone with a 175 LSAT could be refused. Yes, because it is a first screening. So the way the decisions are made, so each file is read by one or more committee members who does a holistic review. So each member looks at everything together, makes a recommendation. There could be several readers. And so it ends up that there are two levels of comparisons. So the first level is that committee reader who gets your file will evaluate it with the knowledge the knowledge that they have of other files they've read of their limited pool. So, if they've read 150 files up to that point in that cycle, that's what they will have as a reference point. So that comes into play. So there's a first comparative exercise with each member. And then ultimately, all the files come back for an evaluation compared to the entire pool with a final decision maker, which is me. So there are like two levels. And you might come out with a lot of positive elements out of the first one, But in light of the entire pool, when we know that year what that is, then there's another level of selection. When you are refused, very rarely, and I'm serious, there are very few files that are uncompetitive across the board. I don't know if they self-select not to apply. There are very few. So a lot of the files have a number of good elements, but there were, again, as I said, more candidates who had across the board stronger elements for the number of spots available. Okay, so it might not have looked like it, but your refusal letter was tailored to you. And this is something that the committee can does. We have the option of, I mean, there are parts of the refusal letter that are standard, the first paragraph, I think, and the last one. But what comes in between is what the committee decides to give you as a reason for the refusal. So we will go through each of these possible letters and explain to you what that means to the committee so that you can narrow down what the reasons were for your refusal. So the first one is the most popular one and I guess the more general one that states that there were positive elements in your application, but it was not overall competitive. So this means, in practical terms, there were a mix of positive. When I say negative, it's negative compared to the ones we make offers to. There were a mix of weaknesses and possibly strengths. But there was not one element in the file that was a glaring mistake, because if that had been the case, you would have gotten another letter. So there were several non-competitive elements. So you might have come close on several, but overall it didn't come together as competitive. Another possible letter you could have gotten is that the academic portion of your candidacy was not competitive. And this is the letter we choose when the academic, it was obviously the determining factor, and it was kind of out of the ballpark. And we'll see later on what that ballpark is. So this is a hard one because unless the academic portion is something that has happened and is forever yours in the sense that you will have these transcripts forever. So unless you have a superb LSAT or you go and do a master's and you perform really well and everything else keeps getting better and better and better, by a good margin, you're unlikely to be admitted if you reapply. So I pressed it twice. So the other possible postscript you can use is that your French proficiency, we could say English, but as I said, it usually doesn't happen that we tell someone who applied to McGill that they don't have a proficiency in English. So insufficient French is something you could have gotten. And that's, we use that when it's, again, quite glaring to us that the level of French is really not appropriate. If someone has, kind of a borderline French, usually there would be other reasons for the refusal, and that might be something that could have been improved. But if we choose that postscript, usually it means that it was a determining factor, possibly even at that first screening stage that I talked about. That's hard to take anyway. You don't know what it means about the rest of your file, either because it didn't get read any further, or it did, but you're not going to know whether it was strong or not. So it could have been uncompetitive on other grounds, or it could have been strong. So maybe by just attending this workshop and working through it, you'll be able to see if you had positive elements or competitive elements, and then if you fix the French part, then then you might be in a good position to reapply. Another postscript we can use is that your undergraduate degree would not have been finished by the time you would register in law school. As you know, our admission eligibility criteria on the academic front in the university category is that you have to have at least 60 credits of university studies. I think that is a rule we adopted a long time ago, and it is a minimum, but the nature of the program and the pool is so competitive that we, in effect, do not admit anyone who's in an undergraduate program but would not have finished. So everyone's in their last year. It's very, very, very anecdotal that we would ever admit someone who hasn't finished their undergrad, and there would need to be very compelling reasons to do so in the eyes of the committee, even though on paper it could be a possibility. So whether you were strong, excellent, or just average, if you wouldn't have been finished with your degree, you would get that letter. So, and we encourage all of those in that category to reapply when they're going to be finished with their degree. Another postscript that exists is a mention that we know you've gone through an interview process. This is rarely used. Those who have applied from CJEP and got a... and did get an interview and then were refused after a CJEP interview would not be getting that letter. They would be getting a specific CJEP letter that would encourage them to apply after their undergrad. So this is more factual, kind of to personalize the letter when we know that you have come either as a mature or a university candidate. In some cases, if you've come for an interview, we'll just kind of make it more personal. You can infer from that the interview probably was a determining factor in the decision. And then finally, another type of letter you could get, in addition to the subtleties I mentioned about being a refused CJEP applicant after interview, is just any application that had a lot of positive elements, we can choose to invite them to reapply in the next cycle. So this is like the best of the answers of the letters you could have gotten. It means there were many good elements. It was just borderline, but not quite weightless material. Or it may also mean that there's something that needs to be fixed. That's kind of our way. Let's say everything is really good, but the LSAT is really, really weak. We might put that there in a sense. Narrow it down to what your weakness was and fix it, and you might stand a good chance. It might also be the French, although, I mean, if you get the refused because of the insufficient French, you're obviously encouraged to reapply once you fix that. So, not too painful, no? Okay. I don't know if you looked at your letter before coming, but when you go back and look, you'll get some information. So, this is where we'll move through the different components of the past application, having that knowledge of which letter you got, and this is where you'll need to be kind of self-aware and open and look objectively at your personal statement and your refusal letter and your past application, and then we'll narrow it down for you on what you need to work on. Okay, academic competitiveness. Maybe I thought I would mention why we're competitive, why we're demanding on the academic front. Might be a bit self-explanatory. But, I mean, the program here at a normal pace is 15 to 18 credits, which is considered very, very full-time in a, you know, more of a regular undergraduate program. In law, there are a lot of readings, and it's very demanding to get through stay on top of the materials. So, and also the pool being competitive, we end up with this great, super smart, super disciplined class that has kind of raised the bar of the expectations of the professors. So we find ourselves in a situation where a good student in undergrad might make it through, but it might be quite a challenge. So the faculty tells us, you know, we have to keep the academic standards up, even though a 75% out of university is really not a bad average at all. So this is just a little bit of context on the academic competitiveness. And as I said, what's difficult about looking back to your own refusal application is that this is the academic portion is something that will continue to follow you. And if it is uncompetitive, it will continue to bring your file down. So we'll work together on how to help with that. So if you look through the leaflet, you would have seen this already. So this is the entering averages of the class. From year to year, it doesn't vary that much, although the LSAT has come up by quite a few points in the last 10 years. So to put a bit more context to that, and it's in the brochure, because we have a holistic approach and we don't have a formula on how to just decide who gets admitted, there is quite the range. And so the range you will have seen in the last few years, we did admit someone down to 75% all the way up to 93. For the R score, we did admit someone in the last 3 years with a 30.8 R score. And we do go down to the low 150s for the LSAT. So this is the part, usually it elicits a lot of questions. So if you have some, I'm happy to answer them at the end of the presentation. However, you'll see from the brochure, and this is new information that has been put together, the 25th percentile of the class is already at 82%. So there would be only 24% of the class that has less than an 82. And for the R score, the 25th percentile is 33, and the LSAT is 160. So I guess that puts a little bit more context into how many kind of exceptions we do make to lower academic performance. Usually we have 5, 8 maybe that have an entering average under 78%. Which is still a high B+. So. If you are a CGIP applicant and your R score was not that at all, if you reapply after an undergraduate, know that there will be not that much weight put on your CGIP performance. So the two applications are almost like two different people. We have admitted university candidates who did well in university with our scores of like 27 or 28 or 29. And it's a long time ago. We don't necessarily always know why those grades were lower, but so just to put a bit of context. So if you've been refused and you have these types of grades, obviously you're in range, then you're like, well, what's the problem? And so know that in terms of just determining the academic performance of your file, we will look at the level and progression of your curriculum. If you do challenge yourself into higher level courses, we will look at the rigor of the program. We will look at the class averages when we have them in each of the classes you've taken. And we will also look at the presence or the recurrence of easy courses. So all of these elements, if they're not showing a good level of challenge, although the numbers might look good, the appreciation of the committee of that academic performance might have mitigated what the numbers indicate. So that's one thing. And then if you do have these grades and you were really challenging yourself academically and still got refused, then we will look at why, and the why is the other part of the application. Donc le profil plus concurrentiel du dossier, au-delà du dossier scolaire, ce qu'on pense que vous pourriez apporter à la faculté. Alors, les différents éléments qu'on regarde, le CV. Un CV moins compétitif est un CV qui... Le CV, ça peut être, il y a tellement de possibilités que c'est difficile de donner vraiment des directives claires. Puis, en fait, le but, c'est de ne pas en donner. Il y a différentes combinaisons gagnantes, les études avec des bonnes notes, le travail, les études, le sport, le bénévolat, tout, la musique, tout ça peut être très positif. Mais ce qui peut rendre un CV moins compétitif comparé au bassin, c'est l'aspect... leadership versus un rôle plus passif dans vos implications. Donc, quelqu'un qui choisit de s'inscrire dans 8 clubs étudiants, mais qui est juste membre, puis on ne sait pas vraiment trop ce qu'ils ont contribué dans leurs implications, ça peut être moins impressionnant que quelqu'un qui a un rôle de leadership. La profondeur de l'engagement, ça revient un peu à la même chose par rapport à quelqu'un qui s'éparpille un peu partout. C'est la même. Quelqu'un peut avoir une ou deux activités en dehors des cours, mais qui sont vraiment soutenues, qui montrent beaucoup de dévouement et d'engagement par rapport à cette cause-là. Ça peut être plus gagnant, justement, que quelqu'un qui essaie d'être un peu partout. L'essai personnel, bien, la lettre de présentation personnelle. Prenez le temps de la relire, votre ancienne lettre. Ce qu'on voit souvent... dans les dossiers refusés, est-ce que vous avez répondu aux 3 questions avec suffisamment de profondeur? Ou est-ce que vous effleurez les sujets? Et des fois même, la question de pourquoi le droit n'est pas vraiment... Bon, les gens ne répondent pas vraiment à cette question-là. C'est comme s'ils présumaient que parce qu'ils font une demande, évidemment, qu'ils sont intéressés en droit. Oui, mais c'est un exercice de réflexion qui est fait pour vous aider dans votre démarche, pour être sûr que vous voulez... venir ici, puis pour nous convaincre que vous êtes capable d'avoir cette réflexion-là. Donc, c'est des choses à garder en tête. Les lettres de référence sont pratiquement toujours positives. Donc, si une lettre est négative, ça peut arriver, là, ça pose un problème, parce que c'est vraiment rare. Quelqu'un qui ne recommande pas l'admission, ça, c'est vraiment, vraiment très rare, mais qui dit « I'm sorry, I cannot recommend admission ». C'est sûr qu'on en demande 2. Alors, si l'autre est excellente, on va peut-être se dire il y a eu un problème ou en tout cas, il y a quelque chose avec ce répondant-là. Bon, vous l'avez choisi. Alors, ça c'est vraiment, ça peut être vraiment néfaste pour votre candidature. Sinon, les problèmes qu'on peut voir sans que ce soit une recommandation négative, elle peut être positive, mais si elle soulève des problèmes, par exemple, à respecter les dates limites, des problèmes de communication... Encore là, c'est quelque chose qui va soulever un petit drapeau rouge dans la tête du comité. Même si elles sont positives, elles peuvent être un peu moins impressionnantes quand ça semble être du copier-coller. Du copier-coller, que ce n'est pas une lettre très personnelle. C'est de quelqu'un qui vous connaît plus ou moins, qui ne donne pas beaucoup de détails sur votre performance. Ce qu'on voit des fois, c'est des lettres académiques qui... parle surtout de la personnalité de l'étudiant. Ils vont dire, ah oui, il venait en classe, silencieuse, respectueuse, ou a posé quelques questions pertinentes, ou je sais qu'elle est très, très impliquée à l'extérieur des cours. C'est positif, là, tout ça. Mais ça, c'est comme un minimum pour nous. On s'attend d'un professeur qui ben, c'est un minimum, ou c'est presque un peu hors sujet, dans le sens qu'il devrait parler de la performance académique, la qualité des interventions vraiment, ou de la qualité de la recherche, de la rédaction, qui voit vraiment qu'il y a comme une curiosité intellectuelle qui est là. Donc, si une lettre académique ne fait pas mention de ça, elle reste positive, mais elle ne sera pas très distinctive. Alors,
ça, c'est pour les dates de référence. Je vais prendre ma page. Les lettres de recommandation, pardon. Bon, ça, j'en ai déjà parlé des aptitudes linguistiques. C'est un autre élément de notre évaluation, mais c'est vraiment binaire, dans le sens que il faut avoir le minimum, puis le minimum pour nous est quand même assez élevé, ou sinon, ça sera un refus. Et ça, je voulais juste clarifier que c'est pas comme le dossier scolaire, dans le sens qu'un 87, c'est plus compétitif qu'un 81, par exemple, dans l'absolu. Mais quelqu'un qui est parfaitement bilingue ne sera pas plus compétitif que quelqu'un qui a notre minimum de bilinguisme passif. Donc, nous, on veut s'assurer qu'il y a ce dont on a besoin, puis la distinction et la comparaison se fait sur d'autres facteurs. Alors, les circonstances atténuantes, ça entre en ligne de compte dans l'évaluation, surtout du dossier scolaire, pour donner du contexte à une performance, peut-être une session où était plus faible, et ça peut éventuellement aussi mettre un certain contexte au CV. Évidemment, quand il y a des problèmes, par exemple, de santé, c'est sûr qu'il y aura peut-être une année où il y aura moins d'activité dans le CV. Donc ça, quand il y en a, c'est pris en compte par le comité. Les circonstances atténuantes peuvent avoir un impact moindre si elles ne sont pas supportées par les preuves externes qui seraient attendues dans ce cas-là. Mais dans tous les cas, elles sont prises en considération par le comité. Et moi, je trouve que les membres du comité sont souvent très, très respectueux de l'information qui est donnée et très ouverts à donner un poids à cette information-là. Donc, they err on the side of the candidate, usually. Donc, ça peut être un élément à prendre en compte. Donc, si des fois, s'il y a quelque chose qui s'est passé que vous n'avez pas révélé dans votre demande, vous avez été refusé, des fois, ça serait bon dans votre nouvelle demande de penser à fournir ces informations-là. Parce que des fois, c'est vraiment comme un point d'interrogation. On a un dossier qui semble prometteur à plein d'égards. Puis là, il y a quelque chose qui est vraiment cloche, puis on n'a pas de réponse. Alors, quand on ne sait pas, on va tirer des conclusions négatives, mais quand on sait, ça peut aider. Alors, so now we're done with the painful part. We will move to the common pitfalls when reapplying, les pièges courants qui affligent les repostulants. Alors là, on regarde vers l'avenir, on regarde votre nouvelle demande, puis on va voir, je vais vous expliquer ce qu'on voit souvent comme piège, mais dans la nouvelle candidature, pas dans le refus. Alors, le plus commun, ces deux-là sont vraiment les plus communs. C'est de faire une nouvelle demande sans vraiment changer grand-chose. On va en parler, là, mais vous savez qu'il y a certains documents qu'il faut resoumettre. Mais des fois, il y a des gens qui resoumettent, puis il y a vraiment presque rien qui a changé substantivement d'une demande à l'autre. Si nous, on fait notre travail de recrutement comme il faut, le bassin va continuer à être compétitif. Et les chances ou le ratio ne va pas changer beaucoup. Donc, si vous ne changez rien, c'est très possible que vous soyez refusé à nouveau. Une exception est peut-être le cas des candidats qui ont été refusés de la liste d'attente très, très tard dans l'été et qui avaient un dossier qui avait beaucoup d'éléments positifs. Ceux-là vont logiquement faire une nouvelle demande seulement quelques mois plus tard. Il n'y a pas tellement de temps pour changer quelque chose, mais ça peut quand même être une nouvelle demande qui va être acceptée parce qu'il y avait de bons éléments, puis on comprend qu'il n'y a pas tellement de temps Mais quand quelqu'un, vraiment d'un cycle à l'autre, là, d'une année à l'autre, quand il y a 12 mois ou plus, ou entre un cégepien qui devient un universitaire, il faut qu'il y ait de nouveaux éléments. Dans le dernier cas, c'est quand même inévitable qu'il y ait des nouveaux éléments. Mais ça, on le voit. Une autre possibilité qui est comme une petite subtilité par rapport à l'élément, le premier, comme, le premier piège, c'est le fait que certains candidats, après être refusés, vont renchérir puis continuer à améliorer ce qui était déjà fort dans leur dossier, mais ne vont pas chercher à améliorer leur faiblesse. And I've read a lot of files, and if there is a major weakness in your file and it doesn't get addressed, the committee will never get past it. So you can't wait for your luck to turn or for the pool to become less competitive. You need to address your weaknesses. And this is where we see human nature at work. It's always easier to work on what you're good at than face head on what you were not as strong in. So, and typically that is the academic performance. So someone has another great internship on their CV, and so that part of the file keeps getting better, but they're not redressing the weakness. So another, it's all in the same vein that you need to adapt to the reality of your refusal, and you need to work on improving your strengths. Again, what we see often is people who don't change their linguistic abilities. Again, it's not easy. Learning another language is a lot of work. So the natural tendency might not be to want to change that part. So, as I said, overall, it's a lack of adaptability. Okay. I just want to make sure I didn't forget anything. Okay, another... I'm going to go back, actually. Another pitfall we see, more specifically about the personal statement, is that the new personal statement only really speaks about the fact that they were refused, and what sometimes in not too positive terms, and what they have done since, which is usually positive. So they really focus on that aspect and forget to mention to answer the three questions that we want to see in any personal statement. Other pitfalls that you don't want to do, and it's you don't want to burn bridges. There is nothing, absolutely nothing negative about having been refused and reapplying. But if you, in your attitude, decide to be really negative with us about your refusal, it will it might raise a question about your judgment, and it might not be such a positive thing. And it might be in the nature of law students or aspiring law students to want to argue and want to build their case and want to fight an injustice, and they see their own refusal as an injustice. That's all fair, but a good lawyer would do it with intelligence, with respect, and with integrity, and a real ability to listen to the other side. So if in the way that you've been handling your refusal, the public part of your behavior around your refusal is showing a lack of these qualities or a lack of judgment or maturity, or it's the soft part of it, but it might not have a good effect. And these qualities are all things we look for in our admissions policy. So I don't think it's anyone here, but there are a few cases a year that really shoot themselves in the foot for no good reason, because to be refused and to want to reapply is a very usual and positive thing. So keep it that way. So a common pitfall is the lack of that. So a few more points of information. So useful tip, obviously avoid common pitfalls. Be open, lucid, adaptable. You're here, you're keeners. It's only September 16th. I'm not worried about you, but this is a overall for the 900 who are refused. This is probably good advice. So in practical terms, what can I do to redress my what in relative terms turns out to be a lack of academic competitiveness? And so this is the crux of the matter for a lot of cases. If you have not written the LSAT and you're comfortable enough in English, writing the LSAT might be something to consider. If you have written it and the score was low, you might think of rewriting it. Others might decide to do a graduate degree. And what Stacey was saying about all the different paths that have led to law school, obviously a number of them, about 20%, chose to do that. So it's a possibility. It will add academic material to your dossier, even though as a comparative baseline, we do use the undergraduate performance in terms of the numerical side of your application. What I mean by that is, so the academic performance has two components. We need to have a number for each file because we run statistics on these things. So we will compute your average GPA in your undergraduate or CGEP, and that will be a 79 or an 85. And then the committee will look, regardless of that number, is going to look at all of the grades in each of your classes. So, and so the undergrad has more weight, certainly is the only factor in determining that numerical number, and the committee does find undergrad performance more relevant to knowing how you would perform in this undergraduate setting. But nonetheless, if you do really well in your master's program, it will bring your file up for sure. Some people choose to let's say they really had a bad undergrad experience altogether, you know, a different phase in their lives. Some people will decide to go and do another undergrad, which is a huge undertaking, but that can be what is warranted in some cases. Obviously, master's and additional studies is a big commitment, so you have to make sure you want to do these for reasons other than to improve your application to make a law. Obviously, you're going to be miserable if that's the only reason you're doing it. Another possibility regarding the academic performance, if ever you do have strong enough grades to be admitted to another law school in Canada, you might want to take up that opportunity. First of all, you'll be getting closer to your goal to have a law degree, and it will be a chance for you to earn some more grades in an area that is very relevant to us. So we don't have a lot of transfer applications, and we know that the quality of law schools across the country is quite good across the board. Obviously, some law schools, are a lot more competitive to get into than others, but none of them are bad. So if you go into another law school and do really well, first of all, you might love it, fall in love with the place, and just want to continue there, which is fine. Or if you still have McGill in mind, then you can look to transfer. Kind of an underused Another tip is that you should check the admission instructions every year that you apply. There might be some changes. This year we don't have any major change to communicate, but last year we had changes to the format of the length of the CV and regarding the reference letters. So it will look good if you can, well, you would need to comply, but let's say last year we got reapplicants who submitted CVs that were too long, well, then it looks like you didn't bother to read the instructions. So make sure you're up to date. And also, sometimes the admissions committee decides to issue kind of general guidelines that might help you. For example, a few years ago, we decided that we would tell people that if they have an academic performance under our entering average, then they should consider writing the LSAT, which is something we didn't explicitly say before. So, you know, there might be things for you to help you. So, what goes into a new application? A lot of it is on our website. Just so you know, we keep files for 3 years. After that, they're shredded. So if you're applying after more than three cycles, you don't have anything. So you will have to provide everything anew. If it's less than 3 years, we will have your old file. And some people sometimes wonder what that means, is that we will pull it out when we see you're reapplying. It will be next to your new file for the consideration of the committee. And the committee will not, most likely because it's double the work, go through every part of the past application, but I know that they will definitely look at the reasons for the refusal. They might go back and look at parts of the personal statement and try to see how the file has progressed since the last application. But as you've seen, it's very common to be a reapplicant, so it's nothing to be really worried about, that they'll see that you were refused. Really, it's quite common. So, nonetheless, if you reapply, you have to resubmit a new application online. You have to pay another $100. You have to provide a new CV, a new personal statement for the transcripts. For the transcripts and the reference letters, it will depend. If the transcripts you had submitted in your previous application were not the final ones, for example, that showed that you actually did graduate that summer, you would need to submit new transcripts. Again, if it's CJEP, we will be getting that directly from the system, so no need to worry about that. And then obviously, if you've done any graduate work or any graded summer, university summer courses and things like that, you would need to submit that as well. Again, if you've written an LSAT or a new LSAT, a second LSAT, you would need to highlight that for us. The reference letters, it depends. You need to submit two. If we have them from less than 3 years ago, you can choose to resubmit one or two of the old ones that you had. You can do so. I mean, take into consideration what we've said about reference letters and their content. If more time has gone by, not getting at least one new reference letter might look a bit strange. So, for example, typically someone who goes from CJEP 2-3 years later applying in university, obviously we would expect university letters. Again, wonder if they were academic letters as well. The caveat to that is for mature applicants, so applicants who have been out of school for 5 years or more, it's very typical to receive at least one of the two be a professional reference letter. So, but these are kind of general instructions for new or reapplicants, so I won't go into that too much. But there is a decision that you'll have to make about your reference letters. Oh, another tip, or I've touched on it. The new application has to, even though you know that we'll have your old one, don't presume anything about the committee going back and reading anything. Your new application has to stand on its own feet. address all the questions we need addressed as if you were a new applicant. So, and that's something sometimes we, as I've explained, that we don't see, and it's unfortunate. Okay, I think. Okay, let me look at the time. Okay, not bad. We will get into the Q&A part, so, and Stacey is still with us. I will focus as much as I can on answering questions that are specific to the reapplicant experience. And if I get all of those out of the way, then if, you know, we can take some time to answer general admissions questions you might have. Okay. Okay. So would an application be considered for a candidate seeking to exit an MA program before its completion? So I imagine this is someone who has, let's say, not been admitted after an undergrad, decided to undergo a master's, continue to build that academic profile, and then they reapply. How will it factor in into the application? So what we do when we see candidates have an ongoing master's program, we will admit them conditionally on them finishing their master's. And this is... The main reason for that is that, well, I don't think legally we're allowed to have a student registered in two programs because there's an issue with, like, government subsidies per student and kind of double-dipping type of reasoning. So there's that. And mainly in practical terms, we don't want someone here who has an unfinished graduate program because then they'll need, you know, submitting a thesis is a big investment of their time, and then they show up at the other side of the floor asking to defer their exams and go part-time and all of these, and we don't want that. So we ask people to finish what they start and then come by making it a conditional admission. It does happen that candidates will ask us, this was my admission, but I'd rather just drop my master's if I can, and would that change anything? I would say the default answer is that your master's is an element of what made your file competitive this time around, so we would expect you to complete it. In some cases, maybe not reapplicant cases, because it's not what we base the most of our academic performance evaluation on, if the rest had been very strong and the rest of the file, the CV and personal statement, everything else is very strong, then we could lift the condition upon proof that the program was exited. So it's, if ever you find yourself admitted and in that kind of happy dilemma, you should contact the admissions office and we can discuss it, see with you, and we can be frank with you about, well, had we known you wouldn't finish or you wouldn't have a master's, you were too borderline initially. So maybe in the context of a reapplication, I would say kind of reapply when you know you will have finished your, give yourself the time to finish your master's degree. Okay, so this is a question, it's like a categories question. So this person is an older applicant with an undergraduate degree, but who has gone back to CGEP in a technical program. Could I apply as a CGEP candidate? I don't. If there's, it's the highest degree that will, the highest degree will determine the category you will go into. However, the grades in CGEP will be more recent, and they will be part of the evaluation. So, but in terms of knowing what deadline to align yourself with, then you would still be considered a university applicant for that purpose. But I understand, let's say, in the context, someone who, you know, wants to bring other elements to their file to maybe bring up the academic component or something like that, or just wants to qualify, have some skills to qualify for a profession, then it makes perfect sense to do so, and it will have a new element in your file. So, but the deadline would, yeah, the category would be the highest, your highest degree of education. So these are, c'est les seuls deux que j'ai eu. It's a very good question. So the question was, if we wrote the LSAT, I'm repeating for the benefit, if we wrote the LSAT, didn't have a good score, do we now have, and we apply, do we have to disclose it, or can we just let it be? You have to disclose it. Yep. That's, sometimes candidates have a difficult time understanding the why of that. Because the LSAT is not mandatory. The reason it's not mandatory is because in our context in Quebec, none of our peer law schools require it, so we would shoot ourselves in the foot first by making our make it even more difficult for people to apply to us. And also, it's only offered in English. So for these reasons, we don't require it. That being said, when it is there, it is valuable information to have. So, and we, when you go through the application process, there are many prompters that will ask you if you have prior tests to report, and even if you're thinking of doing the test, or if you've registered for a future test, you should disclose that to us, so that we know that there's something coming, so that we hold your file, and that's what happens. We, if there's an element that is destined to be in that file, we will hold your file. We will not circulate it to committee until we have that information. So, yes, you have to disclose it. If it's low, then I would recommend rewriting it. We are not as... Other law schools outside of Quebec require the LSAT. It's like one of the two main components of admission, and a lot hinges on it. For us, it is an important element if it's there, but only about 40% and some of the pool writes it, and about, I don't remember what the distinction is between the pool and the class, but I know in the class it's between 30 and 40% who have written it. So we can't, we have to be a little bit more flexible about how we interpret that, because not every, you know, otherwise it's hard to compare apples with apples. So, but a low score, if you can do something to mitigate that, yeah, for sure. Do you have other questions? Yes. So the question was, if you're a CEGEC applicant and you apply in the following year as you're in your first year of university, will we look at the university grades? The category is defined as, for a CEGEC applicant, you can be a CEGEC applicant up until the end of your first year of the university. So we will look at the grades, and you're very welcome to try reapplying. It might be more successful, statistically speaking, to wait until the end of the undergrad, because then the undergrad grades will really drown out the CEGEP grades, whereas when you apply in March, we will have only one term, which is the fall term, as opposed to four terms of CEGEP grades. So even if you do very well, it might not balance, it might not be high enough to counter. If then I'm kind of presuming the R score was below the competitive range. But yeah, so if that was a factor, academically speaking, there might not be enough there to make the academic portion competitive. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? Oui, yes. Sure. So the question was on about the composition of the admissions committee. So the admissions committee is composed between 7 and 10 faculty members. And we also have student representatives on the admissions committee. So they are chosen. They are nominated by the Law Student Association, and they must be students in their last year so that they read the files and go. They will never have as classmates the students, the files that they might have read, for obvious confidentiality reasons. And so that's the composition of the committee as a group. And then there's me, who was also a member of the admissions committee. And the composition will, it depends. There are some who stay for 8 years straight. There are some who do it for a couple of years and then are put on other committees. So it's a mixed bag. There are more experienced readers, newer readers. So I don't know if you have any follow-up on that, but are there any alumni? No, not on the admissions. It's a lot of work. It might be too... I'm sure there are law schools. There are different models of committees. Some of them might have alumni. I know some law schools, I know in the U.S., hire recent graduates to kind of pluck through the files. Here, there are senior law students and permanent faculty members, but no alumni. Yes. Yes. The question was about rolling admissions and what that means, and if you apply very early, does the process start right away? The term rolling admissions usually is used more in the... I know in the U.S. it's more of a well-known term, and it's meant to say they make offers at they have like different stages in their process. We, technically speaking, do not have a rolling admission. And our window to apply is only 2 months, so September 1st to November 1st, for most applications, and then we have the CGEP deadline. And so it's not a huge window to be able to make a distinction between the early appliers and the late appliers. If someone does complete their application, and we have a few who have everything in by this time, they're ready to go, they would be circulated earlier on. Whether it means that at the end you will receive an answer earlier, not necessarily. And I can explain why that is the case. So if a file is circulated early, it will be there are different steps of review. If it is very strong or obviously very weak, we will make those decisions quickly, especially the very strong ones. Obviously, our goal as an admissions office is to make the offers to the strongest candidates first, just because we want to do whatever we can to get them to come, because we presume they would be getting offers from elsewhere. So those would be the ones that we have like an internal triage system to try to flag those and make offers early. So those would hear early. And then we try to keep up with the non-competitive ones quickly too. And if they have been circulated early, they might get an answer. Where it's not as predictable is if a file is more gray, so there are positive and negatives in that file, we will wait until we have seen enough of the pool to make a decision as to whether that file is strong or not. So although it might have had all the first steps done early, it might, because of its character, might be waiting until a bigger part of the pool is seen. If someone applies after October 1st, then, I mean, human nature is what it is. Most people apply kind of last minute or so. So then I would say between October 1st and November 1st, the deadline that you're just in the bulk of everyone else applying, and we will not be making distinctions as to, you know, we will not prioritize so that the file completed on October 15th is circulated earlier than the file completed on October 25th. So, yes or no, there's a bit of yes and no, but it's not, technically speaking, it's not rolling, because we do wait to see the entire pool before we make those gray zone decisions. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions peut-être pour Stacy? Non? Bon, c'est pas trop mal, hein? On va finir à l'heure. Alors, je vais éteindre le microphone. Si vous avez des questions, nous sommes trois à pouvoir y répondre, mais je pense qu'au nombre qu'on est, on va être capable de répondre aux questions de tout le monde rapidement. Alors, merci beaucoup d'être venu. Si vous pouvez prendre un moment pour remplir le sondage, et ça nous fera plaisir de répondre à vos questions maintenant ou plus tard dans le processus, si vous en avez d'autres. Merci beaucoup.